I'll make preliminary remarks while you're settling in. The panel has previously been introduced. I want to remind you, well, first of all, I want to welcome you to live Court of Appeals at the Judicial Center. Some of you are making a first-time return. We're glad to actually have face-to-face hearings. Each of you has 15 minutes to state your case on behalf of your client. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellant for rebuttal purposes if you choose to use it. You each should introduce yourself as well as state what party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. And again, that's for recording purposes. So I don't need to say anything about Zoom. Well, when you're ready, appellant counsel, you can approach.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Nelson. I represent the appellant, Ron Jaeger. Your honors, the facts of this case are not in dispute. This means that all the facts and circumstances of Mr. Jaeger's incarceration at the Steele County Detention Center, the SCDC, are available to this court for consideration. Now, while respondent has and will continue to focus on Mr. Jaeger's conduct to justify the jail's treatment of him, we would like you to consider the following. Mr. Jaeger is not unique. Frankly, our jails and prisons are full of problem inmates just like Mr. Jaeger who are untreated, mentally ill individuals. It is the manner in which the SCDC treated Mr. Jaeger that is at issue. Specifically, this court must decide whether Mr. Jaeger is entitled to a new trial because the jail's unprecedented treatment of him violated his constitutional rights to self-representation, access to discovery, and access to the courts, which ultimately worked together to violate his right to a fair trial. The record is clear. Four of Mr. Jaeger's attorneys testified that they have never seen such treatment of an inmate in a jail like this before. In fact, one of his attorneys, Paul Spahalski, testified that when he first went to see Mr. Jaeger, he was given the Hannibal Lecter speech. No contact with Mr. Jaeger, don't approach the glass, don't hand him anything, and don't bother sending him anything because we're not going to give it to him. I myself have been practicing for 20 years in public and private defense, federal and state court, and I have yet to see the likes of anything like this. Please do not let respondent minimize the unrefuted testimony. For example, Mr. Jaeger was kept in a jail cell with the lights on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with nothing to occupy his mind.
That to me sounds more of a complaint as far as something that this appellate court is not dealing with. We're dealing with your request for a new trial based on his inability to consult with counsel.
His inability to consult with counsel, to get the discovery, to access the courts, simple access to pencil and paper.
And the response is, of course, that we had to balance the circumstances because of his extensive history of interaction with safety concerns or his presence with safety concerns. Isn't that what the state is pretty much arguing?
That is what the state is arguing, but the state is trying to argue this under a section 1983 case. So that this is really a civil case that they want to apply civil standards to from Turner into this case. And that doesn't work here because this isn't a civil case and we're not looking for a civil remedy.
So I completely understand that argument. In fact, it seems that the briefs in this case are sort of two ships that pass in the night in terms of the standards that we're being asked to apply. You're asking us to apply a structural error standard, and what I'm wondering is, to apply structural error, we have to find that the resulting trial, looked nothing like a trial should because there was some sort of a structural defect in the trial process itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what that defect was specifically.
So specifically that defect was Mr. Jaeger's right to self-representation was violated because he was not allowed, essentially, to prepare for trial with some of the very basic means of access to the state's discovery. He didn't have a pen and a pencil in his cell at night to prepare for the next day's hearings. I can't imagine a prosecutor being told, you need to go prosecute someone, do a week-long trial, and by the way, you only get access to the discovery, a pencil and a paper while you're at counsel table. I guarantee you, if that was the case, the state wouldn't be saying, that's okay.
The state's response to that is, look at the trial. The trial seemed pretty fair. He did a pretty good job representing himself, and I'm wondering what your response is to that.
So Mr. Jaeger cannot be punished for being able to think on his feet. And that's not an answer to, well, he did okay, therefore it was okay that he wasn't given the same opportunities to prepare as opposing counsel was. The fact that he did a good job, and it looks like he did, imagine what he could have done had he actually had the opportunity to prepare in the same manner that the prosecutor was allowed.
Then let's back up, because he represented himself. So before that, he had a public defender and then the litany of individuals that represented him. What I keep coming back to is that if his attorney-client relationship was impeded upon, what was the harm from the intrusion? And the state didn't learn, to my knowledge, the state didn't learn anything from all of these obstacles that you're saying he had. In other words, the jailer being right down the hall or not having the privacy that he would have been afforded. And there was nothing that was used to his detriment. So starting with his representation or his ability to act and meaningfully with counsel, how was that thwarted by the ultimate trial process?
Had he been able to... The relationship between a public defender and a defendant, especially one who's in jail, is very unique, and it is a very fine tightrope that one has to walk to develop that relationship. Not being able to develop it, not being able to have a contact with him, having to speak with him, either yelling at him through plexiglass or having to speak through a cuff pass, absolutely affected Mr. Jaeger's ability, infected the public defender's ability to be able to contact
with him. Did the attorneys at that time file any objection or claim or anything with the court? What did they do?
Well, again, at that point, their concern was his competency, so that's what they were looking at. They were looking at his competency. That was the concern, so that's when the Rule 20 started getting filed. It was not a matter of...
Well, I understand that, but you can't have it both ways. Either they're focusing on his competency or they're saying, oh, we do not have a meaningful ability to interact with our client, and you complain, and if it was denied, I could see that you have some kind of a record, or you'd say the jailer went and ratted out our discussion and told the prosecutor that he had this, and the prosecutor says they're going to use that. I don't see any of that happening. So differentiate between the two.
So had he had... I think it's an ongoing spectrum of what happened. Had he had a better relationship with his first attorneys, he may not have represented himself. He may have had counsel.
Can I interrupt just for
sure.
And I apologize for doing this, but is it correct that there was a year between maybe May of 18 and June of 19 where he was able to meet in a separate room with counsel? So this whole idea of not being able to develop a relationship with his PDs. I mean, is that right? And then what was the problem with that year? Are you really focusing just on from when he was put back on suicide watch through the trial, or is it before that?
So the trial, the 1 year that he was in DSEG was after he returned from Anoka. He had been in Anoka for 3 weeks, and what happened there helped him. He was more cooperative when he came back. He was not on suicide watch for a year. But he was still not competent. So he wasn't representing himself, and the focus at that time was there was a problem because his attorney still thought that he was not competent. They wanted to pursue the Rule 20s. It's not unusual that a defendant who is not competent says, hey, no, I'm competent. This is not an unusual thing. It's what happened, though. The part that I'm talking about is the self-representation from June 2019 through the trial, where he was denied his right to represent himself because he didn't have access to the discovery. He didn't have access to courts. He wasn't allowed to properly prepare the way opposing counsel was. That's, I think, the focus on what this court should focus on in terms of the structural error.
So we're not the first court to look at this. You had post-conviction proceedings, yes, and the post-conviction court sat through 3 days, I think, of testimony. And there's a real flavor to the post-conviction court's order that that Mr. Jaeger was manipulating, that he was attempting to delay the proceedings to gain some benefit. What are we to make of the post-conviction court's factual findings to that effect?
I think, again, the facts aren't in dispute. Mr. Jaeger was horrible. He was horrible. He did horrible things when he was in the SCDC's custody. Absolutely. Anthony Butera, who was one of the jail administrators, testified that Mr. Jaeger is one of the top three or four worst inmates they had. But I think what's interesting about that is he didn't say he was the worst. He said he was on top three or four. Mr. Jaeger is not unique. He is not unique. This can't be about Mr. Jaeger's behavior. This needs to be about the SCDC's behavior. And the court, the district court, post-conviction court, one of the things that it did to reach its conclusion was that it focused, again, on these civil standards that are used for, matters where inmates are complaining about housing problems that affect their constitutional rights. But
it is the same. I mean, the standards of proof, the burden of proof is quite a bit different, but it's the same constitution. So you can't have a 1983 claim in a civil case without, at least successfully, without there actually being a violation of constitutional rights.
Correct. But the difference...
But you're saying it's just that they're trying to say, no, this is all about a cruel and unusual punishment, and your argument is, no, wait a minute, this is about right to counsel, right to exculpatory evidence, access to courts.
Right to a fair trial.
And,
Your Honor, that is exactly the difference here. In 1983 claims, what the inmates or what the petitioners are always looking for are some sort of injunctive relief. They're attacking the policy itself and want the policy to change. We are not arguing that the jail's policies were improper. We're saying that the implementation of them, the consequence of how they were imposed, affected Mr. Jaeger's right.
What do you believe should have happened? Would the attorney elect to meet with him face to face when he was engaging in conduct that was questioned by the Rule 20 eval?
None of the attorneys testified that they had any problem meeting with him or they had any problem with him at all. So their concerns, they did not have these concerns. As an attorney who's...
So then they didn't complain about it.
Right. They didn't have a problem with Mr.
Jaeger. That circle.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, what I'm getting at is if... The attorneys, my question was, what, if anything, should they have done as far as providing, you're saying his right to counsel was violated, his rights were violated, his due process rights were violated, the state is saying that they were burdened, they weren't violated, what should they have done? What could they have done other than the precautions that they implemented?
All sorts of things. He was a mentally ill, untreated person. When the court found him incompetent, it said he should go to recompetency programming. That never happened. The state was ordered to start civil commitment proceedings. The state started it, but they backed off because, frankly, what they really wanted was they wanted to convict him and put him in prison. That's what happened. So they could have put him, they could have civilly committed him, at which time he could have had all sorts of opportunities for treatment. He could have gone to Fairview, he could have gone to the U, he could have gone to St. Peter, all sorts of opportunities.
He had an attorney for the civil commitment proceedings too, correct?
He did. But with the problem with civil commitment attorneys is that they are representing the interests of Mr. Jaeger, whatever those interests might be, so they are not going to help the state commit him. That's just the way it goes, right? We want to make sure that everybody has a say, even if they're not competent. They get a say in what's happening. The other thing, you know, and here's one thing I would really like to
Sorry, I know you're about to launch into something, but some of the arguments that you're making do have a Section 1983 quality to them, that, you know, the conditions of his confinement were appalling. But again, with regard to your argument that there was a structural defect, I'm just wondering exactly where that manifests in the transcript. He had an impartial judge, he had counsel, he was then allowed to represent himself, he was allowed to cross-examine witnesses. You know, none of those sort of normal trial functions were impeded. And I'm just wondering if you could concisely explain what that structural defect was exactly.
Do the best I can. I would look under State v. Worthy, because that's the Minnesota case that says that defendants have a constitutional right to represent themselves. My argument, or appellant's argument, is simply this. When you deprive a defendant of their right to the discovery, of their right to pencil and paper to prepare for trial, when you deprive them of those things, you are affecting their right to represent themselves. That is a structural defect. How can that not be a structural defect? That is, I think, as concisely as I can put this. I see that I'm out of time.
You'll have your rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ed Stockmeyer, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. The Steele County Detention Center has an obligation to ensure that the facility is safe for its employees, all of its detainees, and anyone who visits the facility. It cannot operate an unsafe facility, and that obligation extends to protecting detainees from themselves if those detainees are suicidal. Here, the restrictions that SCDC imposed were rationally related to that legitimate interest because Mr. Jaeger presented with persistent threats to the safety of the facility, and the restrictions were imposed in response to those threats. This morning, I intend to focus on two issues. First, I will address why Turner applies in this case, and second, I would like to highlight some of the considerations that this court should focus on in addressing the merits of Mr. Jaeger's claim. So as to whether Turner applies, this court should look to what the U.S. Supreme Court has said about Turner's scope. In Washington versus Harper, the court said, quote, Turner applies to all circumstances in which the needs of prison administration implicate constitutional rights. I want to emphasize that. All circumstances, no qualification on that language. It is not reasonable to take this categorical rule and then exempt from it any claim made by every criminal defendant. That is not all circumstances. Second, this court only needs to follow the Minnesota Supreme Court's lead. In State versus Kuipers, which is a criminal case involving complaints about pre-trial detention, the Minnesota Supreme Court cited Turner favorably. It also said that in this context, there needs to be a, quote, mutual accommodation between individual rights protected by the Constitution and institutional needs of the detention facility. That notion of a mutual accommodation between the needs, institutional needs, and rights, that is what is at the heart of the Turner analysis.
Mr. Stockmeyer, can a jail satisfy the four-factor Turner test by placing limitations on an inmate, you know, that are reasonable, but also violate the defendant's right to a fair trial by imposing those limitations? Is it possible to do both of those things, or are you saying that, you know, if they satisfy that four-factor test, who cares about what the trial that they received looks like?
No, Your Honor, I do think that there can be a violation of those rights. We're not saying this is an issue that courts can't remedy or can't review. I think one of the benefits of applying Turner is it asks courts to engage with the circumstances. So it says, was there a rational connection, this is the first factor, between what the legitimate interest is, safety, and what the facility's policies were or what they did. But then there are also additional factors after that. The court has to engage with whether on the facts of the case there were alternate means for the claimant to vindicate their rights. Were there alternate restrictions that the facility could have pursued to the ones that it actually pursued? So I think that's a real benefit of our test, is that it provides for judicial review. It requires the court to actually engage with the facts, but those facts have to include the nature of the conduct and the threats that the facility was facing. That has to be one of the emphasis of the analysis. And in this case, I think if you look at the entire record, particularly the fact that Mr. Jaeger spent significant amounts of time on suicide watch, the facility was just enforcing its policies. And that's really all that was going on.
Did he still have a fair trial? I mean, can you address that part of it? Looking at this trial, were his trial rights, constitutional trial rights, implicated in any way by the restrictions that he faced at the jail?
I think if you look at the course of the trial, there's no reason to think that he received an unfair trial as a result of the restrictions he faced. I do want to make a factual correction on this point that I think is relevant. My friend said Mr. Turner or Mr. Jaeger shouldn't be punished for being able to think on his feet quickly at trial, but that is not what the record reflects about what happened. Mr. Jaeger spent significant amount of time with advisory counsel, to the credit of advisory counsel, reviewing all of the discovery. The advisory counsel would read it to him and so he could know what was in the state's file. Advisory counsel testified that Mr. Jaeger prepared the lines of examination of the state's witnesses on his own. He came up with the confrontations with the witnesses' prior statements. He used the medical records when examining witnesses. And advisory counsel testified that that was really all Mr. Jaeger's work. Advisory counsel developed some of the questions for voir dire, and Mr. Jaeger developed his opening and closing remarks, which I think if you read them, really tracked with what the themes of this case ought to be. So the Mr. Jaeger can't point to anything that actually happened in his trial that was actually different as a result of these restrictions. And his defense came down to what I think is a pretty outlandish account of the facts. And no matter what sort of preparation he had, he was not going to be able to make the jury think that his account of the facts was any more plausible than he was able to at trial. So I think if you just look at, if you engage with the record at trial, is clear, I think, that Mr. Jaeger did not suffer any impediment to presenting a defense or defending against the state's charges. I would also like to go back to my point about why Turner applies, and I had a third reason, in addition to looking at Washington versus Harper and State versus Kuipers. A civil claimant does not have a different constitutional right than a criminal claimant. Turner is not a 1983 rule. It's not about qualified immunity. It's not really about standing. Turner is the substantive rule for whether a right has been violated. And when a reviewing court, eventually in a civil case, gets to that core question, it's the same question that it will face in a criminal case. And whether the answer to that question, whether the claimant's rights were violated, is yes or no, should not depend on whether the reviewing court is presiding over a civil case versus a criminal case. The substantive standard should be the same, and that means that Turner applies because Turner is the substantive standard.
So again, if we find that the restrictions at the jail were reasonably related to legitimate interests applying the Turner test, we can also find that it's okay that a defendant didn't have a fair trial by virtue of those restrictions? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, don't we have an obligation to look at the trial, too, in addition to the restrictions themselves?
I think under Turner, I don't think so, because if the facility didn't do anything wrong under Turner, Wright wasn't violated, then I'm not sure we can say that you can nevertheless reverse.
No, but they're different rights, right? I mean, he had added rights when he's facing a trial. I mean, all incarcerated individuals have the right in Turner. But he had this separate set because he was being tried. I mean, he doesn't give that up because I think that's all we're trying to get at, because he's being held in pretrial detention. So we have to, I mean, so A, you know, was there something unconstitutional about the manner he's being held, which is counsel for Mr. Jaeger is telling us no, that's not what we're arguing. What we're saying is that his additional set of rights that any criminal defendant would have was impinged upon.
So two responses, Your Honor. And just to begin, I understand the sort of concern. The first thing I would say is we heard this morning from my friend that the claim is that the facility should not have done what it did. It was not allowed to do this. And so their claim is not that this trial was unfair or that Mr. Jaeger had suffered particular burdens. They are arguing that SCDC was not allowed to enforce its suicide policy when an inmate or a detainee was placed on suicide watch. And they're not challenging the placement on suicide watch. They are making this claim all about whether the SCDC could have imposed these restrictions. The second point, which maybe answers your question a little more directly, is that if this court is concerned about there being additional considerations because we're dealing with a trial and a defendant's ability to prepare, the state doesn't really have any objection to sort of to an identification of some additional considerations that could be relevant in this context. But the Minnesota Supreme Court in State versus Kuipers cited Turner favorably, and it said there has to be a mutual accommodation between the needs of the facility and the defendant's rights. And really, I think what all that gets to is this is a rational basis test within the context of those decisions. This isn't about, in the abstract, do reviewing courts approve or disapprove of what the facility does. It has to be a balance, and I think that's where we get into the idea of a rational basis review. I would like also to turn to the merits of Mr. Jaeger's claim, and I really want to emphasize the timeline of events here. So beginning in May 2018 and ending on June 13th, 2019, Mr. Jaeger was housed in disciplinary and administrative segregation. That's a full year. The post-conviction court found during that time he had access to his legal materials and the law library if he chose to use it. It's an uncontested factual finding. So during that year, he was fully able to prepare for trial.
Except counsel, Ms. Nelson, said he wasn't competent.
That's factually untrue. The district court found him competent to proceed on May 10th, 2018. That is finding number 21 on page 4 of the post-conviction court's
report. And then he became, because I thought there was something in 2019, May 2019.
There was an additional order finding him competent. And okay. On the same page.
All right.
And page 4 of the post-conviction court's order. After three new evaluations, the court found Mr. Jaeger competent to proceed on May 17th, 2019. My understanding is that in the interim, defense counsel had raised another question about Mr. Jaeger's competency. And so the court was addressing it again. He was not ruled incompetent again, to my knowledge, after May 10th, 2018. So he was competent for that year. And so in addition to that, I think it is, we should also understand that a lot of the restrictions that are laid out in the brief and a lot of the conduct preceded May 2018. That's well
well more than a year before trial. And so I think it's difficult to see how any of those could actually have affected the fairness of Mr. Yeager's trial, particularly when he had a year uninterrupted of much fewer restrictions.
What about the argument that he was deprived of his right to meaningfully represent himself, and that amounted to a structural defect in the trial?
I think, again, if Your Honor looks at the record, it's just not the case. Advisory counsel.
So is your argument that because he did a good job, there was meaningful representation? I guess I'm wondering, you know, how you define meaningful representation?
Your Honor, I guess I'm not aware of a case that talks about meaningful opportunity to self-represent yourself. I think that's usually comes by virtue of electing to represent yourself. And, you know, if you look at State versus Seifert and some of the other cases that are maybe relevant to this issue, the courts are pretty clear that a defendant takes that risk when he elects to discharge his public defenders and represent himself. In this case, Mr. Yeager was already back on suicide watch when he made that decision. He knew these restrictions were being imposed, and he elected to represent himself nevertheless. Even if that doesn't convince you, we still have the record from post-conviction or from advisory counsel explaining how they prepared for trial. And then you look at that in light of Mr. Yeager's performance, the way he examined witnesses, his familiarity with the discovery, and I think it's hard to conclude that he did not receive a fair trial. The other point about the timeline I want to emphasize is I think we heard this morning, the main part of the complaint comes in that period where he was self-represented leading up to trial. Mr. Yeager was placed on suicide watch because he made a threat to his own life. He was not removed from suicide watch for those 7 weeks. It is important to understand that Mr. Yeager is not challenging or alleging that he was improperly placed on suicide watch, is not alleging that he was improperly kept on suicide watch. And so what we're left with is a claim where a facility has a suicidal detainee and they're being asked to just not enforce their suicide protocol. And we have not been told any standard for how a jail should be able to manage that. How do they determine whether a particular suicidal detainee should be subject to the rules or not?
You have like 10 seconds left, and I'm sorry, I do have one additional question. I'm hoping that you can very quickly address the argument that you waived the application of the Turner standard by not arguing it below.
Yeah. Your Honor, a couple points. It's not an issue. We haven't inserted a new issue. Appellant has raised a constitutional claim, and we've identified the level of constitutional scrutiny that applies to the claim. Appellant hasn't offered any alternative level of scrutiny. They're not asking for intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny. They're asking this court to sort of engage in a review that isn't guided by any standard whatsoever. We've just identified the standard of review. Secondly, I think if you look at the state's memorandum, it's actually not true that we sort of never raised these issues. Specifically, I'd point the court to page 38 of the state's post-hearing memorandum. The state, and this is just one of the quotes from that paragraph, I think the whole paragraph is relevant, but deference should be afforded to the judgment of corrections officials, and such deference is at its height when the prison regulations at issue involve security and safety concerns. That tracks our argument here on appeal. So I just disagree that we didn't put this before the court. And finally, I think if you look at the post-conviction court's analysis, the post-conviction court essentially concluded these restrictions were reasonable in light of Mr. Jaeger's conduct, and that's all that we're asking this court to hold. So if there's no further questions, I simply ask this court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stockmeyer. Nelson, you have the last word.
Thank you. A couple things. To begin with, Mr. Stockmeyer is not correct. We don't challenge that the jail implemented these policies. What we're saying is it's the consequence. That is what we're saying. The consequence of these policies is what affected his right to a fair trial. As far as Turner goes, no court that I have been able to find has applied Turner to a case where the defendant is attacking the criminal conviction. If this court applies Turner to this case, this will be precedential. I am unaware of any other court doing this. And here's why Turner can't apply. Here's an example. Let's say that we have an inmate who strikes a prison official, a staff member, kind of like we had here, an assault. And the policy then is to take that inmate and put him into segregation for 2 weeks. That's going to be his discipline. That's reasonable. And when you're in discipline, you only get 1 hour out of your cell a day. That's all reasonable. Here's the problem. That inmate's supposed to be in trial that week. And the jail says, too bad, because he's being disciplined. Now, if he was not allowed to go to trial, this court, I assume, would say, his right to be present at trial was violated. You don't have to go through Turner to get to that result. And that is what the state is asking you to do here. They are asking you to go through a civil framework to look at whether or not a trial was fair and whether or not a conviction can be reversed on that. There are standards that are in place. We do have standards for all of these claims, for whether or not someone's been given the opportunity to represent, the right to represent himself, whether they've had the opportunity and the right to review the discovery, whether they have access to the court. Those standards are already in place. And that is what I'm asking this court to look at and to say, hey, under these very unique circumstances, but not a unique client, not a unique defendant, but unique circumstances, these compile together to affect his ability to have a fair trial.
So if we were to look at Christian versus State of Minnesota, there it talks about right of access to the courts, which is one of the claims you're raising, and that there needs to be some showing of prejudice or actual injury, unless the regulation itself is being attacked. So how do we work that into your argument?
I think the difference, Your Honor, is this. Again, even though it is the same constitutional issue, access to the court, it's the framework of it being a civil matter where the inmate is looking for injunctive relief. Don't put this policy on me.
I don't get that because it's one constitution. I guess I'm not following that. The burden of proof is quite different. But I'm not getting that. It's one constitution and the interpretation, I mean, right of access to courts. All right, I'll let you answer, sorry.
No, I understand. I agree. It is a fine line, and I understand the confusion. But it is one constitution, but the claims are very different. Under Christian and the other civil cases, they've already been convicted. They are not attacking their criminal conviction. They are attacking the policies that surround their housing or that sort of thing. It doesn't affect their actual criminal conviction. So they're actually attacking in those situations the policy itself. This policy should not be allowed. We are not attacking the policy. We're attacking, because that wasn't the way it was imposed, it affected his right to a fair trial, and the result there is then a new trial. I don't know that if I have satisfied your answered your question.
So the we presume injury then, that he didn't, I mean, because anybody would want access to paper and pencil if they were defending themselves.
Correct.
Is that, yeah.
I don't see, I guess the way I would look at this is I don't know, understand how you wouldn't find prejudice under those circumstances. Someone trying to represent themselves and basically having their hands tied behind their back while they're trying to do it.
Are there any cases, I know you said it's the Worthy case, are there any cases where a defendant's right to meaningful self-representation has been violated where you can't point to something like he wasn't allowed in the courtroom or, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that you're asking us to make a very fact-specific conclusion based on not a lot of facts.
To some extent, I am. I am suggesting that under the uniqueness of these circumstances, and no, to answer your question, Your Honor, no, I haven't been able to find a case that is right on point. I don't think there is a case that is right on point here. There really isn't. This is unique. Again, not Mr. Jaeger is unique, but the circumstances are unique. I see I'm out of town. I just ask that you reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Again, I want to compliment the attorneys on the briefing that was presented to this court, as well as the arguments that we heard today. They are extremely helpful. A decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory time frame. With that said, this court will stand in recess to consider our non-oral case presentations. Thank you.